This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to By the Book with me, Lee Chui Lin, and
me, Sharmila Ganesan.
This week, we are talking about adaptations. Adaptations that we've loved, adaptations that we perhaps did not enjoy as much. And the reason why we're doing so is because at the end of this week...
Yes, big, big, big thing happening, at least for us.
Yes, it's true. We do need to caveat this. However, it is the adaptation of Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett's novel, Good Omens.
Armageddon's days away, and we've lost the Antichrist.
We have to work together.
We have nothing whatsoever in common. I don't even like you.
You do.
If we don't find it, it'll be the war to end everything.
Adam, where are we going?
The end of the world. It's not far.
And it's coming out with a stellar cast. It's got Michael Sheen. It's got
David Tennant.
It's just all good.
John Hamm.
It's very exciting.
I know, like, we are all majorly fangirling. We are all, meaning me and Lynn, the two of us.
Yes, but we did want to use it as a jumping off point to talk about adaptations in general, because there have been a lot. And before that, though, we should say, clearly fans of Good Omens, clearly. Yeah. What are you hoping that they're going to be able to capture in the adaptation? Because it's a pretty complex story.
It is. And you know, I was thinking about this even before the trailer had come out. And I think for me, it's, and it's, of course, I'm going to say something that isn't quantifiable. Tone.
Yeah.
There's a certain tone to the book, right? There's this odd combination of humor and darkness and a lot of pathos when you don't expect it. And it's not easy to capture on screen. It's much easier, I think. I'm not going to say easier. That comes through in literary works in a way that is a lot more difficult to do on screen.
I mean, it is a book that has the Antichrist. We should be clear about that. And, you know, the Antichrist has scab knees and he rides around on bicycles, yes, leading a, yes, gang of kids. And it also has, where the pathos is coming from, I think, is from angels and demons having existential crises,
yes,
right? They're just wondering, why are they here? You know, is this all part of some ineffable plan? Mm-hmm. So I agree. I think tone and humor. Are you going to be able to capture the timing? Are you going to be able to capture the shifts that happen throughout? That's the stuff, right? That's what's going to matter.
Yeah, and sort of not letting... I mean, because there is a lot of potential for humor, you know, and this idea of this angel and this demon sort of being... I suppose frenemies in some way, and sort of coming together to ultimately prevent the apocalypse. There's something already very funny about it, but there is that potential for it to turn into, say, what Dogma was, which is Kevin Smith's Dogma, which is very much riding on humor. I'm not sure I want it to be pushed to that extent.
No, because the wondering over what is this all about, it can't just be funny. You know, there's some very genuine religious conversations,
yes,
that actually happen throughout the book. And I don't necessarily want someone preaching at me through the TV screen, but it doesn't mean that I don't want it to be there at all. This conversation kind of captures what we're going to try and address for the rest of the show, because there is this question of what it is that you go into adaptations,
right,
for.
What makes a good adaptation?
Yes, because, yeah, some people, I think, definitely want the story first and foremost to be represented, or they want the characters to look exactly.
With Harry Potter, you get that, with people wanting particular scenes, particular characters, costumes, food.
Off-center lightning scar, never forget.
So, like, some people are very invested in those things, of having just a book come to life on screen for them.
I can appreciate that. I mean, that's part of being a fan, right? And that's part of the problem with fan service in some ways. You just want to have the world be continued in a visual way. I don't always appreciate that. It's one of the reasons why, and I've gone on record saying this, I thought Zack Snyder's Watchmen was awful.
Okay.
Because it was a visually faithful representation of the book.
He storyboarded the comic.
That doesn't mean anything. You know, I can just go back and read the comic to a soundtrack. Like, I have achieved the same thing. So, yeah. What else do we think then have been successful adaptations? We have one that we disagree on. So I think we'll start with that.
And coincidentally, or perhaps not so coincidentally, it's also an adaptation of a work by Neil Gaiman, the TV series adaptation of American Gods. In many ways, American Gods is sort of Neil Gaiman's magnum opus.
Yeah.
You know, it's this sort of love letter to the grand American road movie or road book, I suppose. And it brings together the gods and mortals and is this, how do I even describe what American Gods is?
I think it's an epic that is made up of vignettes.
Yes.
Perhaps that's one way of
and
looking at it.
It draws heavily on, among other things, Norse mythology.
Yes.
So I really loved the TV series. You know, I thought that the adaptation did, you know, what the best of adaptations should do, which is to take that story, stick to the things that are the best about it, but run in different directions as well. And in many ways, because the book is more than 10 years old now, also sort of fitted to our age.
When people first came to America, they brought us with them. We are the ancient ones. Then they built churches, cathedrals, or they'd erect a stone circle.
Dear God, I hope you got the letter and I pray you can make it better down here.
Gradually they abandoned us. Old, forgotten gods. Now there are new gods growing in America.
I can't believe it.
And they want to destroy us. War's a coming, Shadow. I have a big role for you.
So that's what I liked it, but I was shocked to find out that you, Lynn, didn't like it quite as much.
I liked Ian McShane very much.
So did I.
Yes.
I agree.
I will say that he made a wonderful Wednesday, both in the jocular uncle version as well as in the do you know who I really am version. So Ian McShane was great. However, I guess in this sense, I am the unpleasable book fan, which is not to say I didn't watch it. I inhaled the first season and I was looking forward to it greatly for a long time. Neil Gaiman signed off on it. So I thought, okay, yeah. All right, good. But I was never going to be happy. American Gods is one of my favorite books. It's something that I reread every year. I take it with me on trips. It was never, ever, ever going to be good enough, especially not with this version of Shadow.
Yes, I think Shadow, I will admit, is not my favorite thing about the TV series. I feel like the Shadow of the books is a very interior character. A lot of what we know about him is based on his thoughts and his observations and just about how people around him react to him.
Yes.
And the actor, Ricky Whittle, sort of just plays him very stoic. And
yeah.
I think that's part of the problem, that you never connect to Shadow in the TV series. However, I think what this does, it actually allows a lot of the other characters who sort of flit in and out of the story to really shine and become, in some ways, a lot more than they were in the book.
Well, sure. I mean, I can see that. I take the point. But because American Gods is so beautifully told as a story in terms of the book, the language shifts depending on which culture we are in that given moment, which god we're exploring, which facet of belief. I just didn't think a show could encompass all of that, and I should have been able as a viewer to try and appreciate it on its own merits, but I didn't get there, so that was me. Now, on the other hand, the argument could be made that everything would have been fine if Shadow were played by Elizabeth Moss, because Elizabeth Moss
can do everything.
Yeah. And she also played a very internal character in our next adaptation that we wanted to talk about, which is, of course, Handmaid's Tale.
I had another name, but it's forbidden now.
No, please don't take it!
You girls will serve the leaders and their barren wives.
We only wanted to make the world better.
Better?
Better never means better for everyone.
Offered, and I intend to survive.
Yes, Handmaid's Tale is, I think, hands down in the last few years, one of the best adaptations of a book that I've seen. Maybe also because it came out at such a pivotal time, right? At the height
yes.
of Me Too and Trump being elected. And so much of Margaret Atwood's book, which again is a couple of decades old at this point.
Speculative fiction, she'd
yes,
call it. Yeah.
That's right. It sort of modernizes and squarely brings those issues into today. And it the book depressed me and then the show depressed me even more, but I loved it.
I loved the experience of watching it, but I did it wrong because I binged it.
Oh, no.
And yes. And nobody told me not to. So that was
even watching it weekly, like I had to recover afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, I say nobody warned me, but really I should have known better because I'd read the book. So it's not as if I needed a warning. So Margaret Atwood is this, I'm going to sound like a blurb on the back of a book, but she's a masterful storyteller, isn't she?
Yes,
I mean,
she
is precise, she is ferocious, and she writes with a very sort of, where's the thing that's going to hurt you? I found it. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just going to step on it for quite a while. And I think in the case of Handmaid's Tale, anybody would feel that, but perhaps particularly so if you're a woman.
Yes.
Because of the story, right? The story of fertile women in the future being forced to be the sort of...
Yeah, to bear children.
To bear children.
For a society where having babies has become almost nearly impossible. And therefore, a woman's worth is only measured by whether she can procreate.
Or marry well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I made a snarky little aside about Elizabeth Moss, but the truth is that without her, I don't know how, which is not to dismiss the work of Reed Morano, who rendered the world so wonderfully, but Elizabeth Moss and her face, Alexis Bledel and her face, you know, these are the women through whom we see the story, and it's thanks to them that the adaptation works as well as it does.
And I think that, you know, as a counterpoint to what we were talking about with American Gods, is a case of how really sometimes finding the right actor can make or break an adaptation, because it's also about the actor being able to adequately find that connection with the character without just playing a caricature.
Yes, and it depends, I suppose, on how much the character is described. Earlier we mentioned Harry Potter. Harry is, his appearance is reiterated at the start of every book because it is, after all, a series. It started off as a children's book. I'm not sure what it was by the end, but it started off as a children's book. And so you know Harry has startling green eyes that are his mother's eyes. Mm-hmm. You know that he has...
Which wasn't in the movie.
No, it was not. Messy hair, also not in the movie. But you know he has messy hair. You know he's got that lightning scar.
Yeah.
You know very, very specific things about him. And in the case of Shadow, as well as Offred, their physical descriptions aren't so important
in
the book.
They're quite sparse, yeah.
Yeah, so that allows anybody to be anybody.
And both characters, actually, not just physical descriptions, but just in terms of who they are as people, they're very... they're characters that almost recede.
Yeah.
And so you imagine and transpose a lot of your thoughts and how you would react in a scenario to them, which in many ways is why, as readers, you connect to them. And when you watch that on screen, you can't have that same experience. So you need the actor to almost be your stand-in and emote for you in a way that seems authentic.
And part of that, I guess, part of this larger conversation and why I'm glad Good Omens is going to be on TV and not in the movies is because in some ways, TV is the perfect medium for adaptations, I think. The British figured this out a long time ago.
Yes, much earlier than the Americans did.
Yes, but overall, just having more time to sit with characters that readers might have lived with for decades, it's helpful, you know, as opposed to just having 90 minutes now in this modern movie going age, 125 minutes, you know, it's easier to settle in with them and really acclimatize yourself to, oh, this is my Offred. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you have 1 week where they let you get to know a character. The next week, they can move the action along. And then you actually have time to let people around them react. So there's so much more space and so much more potential in the TV form that movies tend to have to make very difficult decisions about.
We're doing sort of a crossover episode today of By the Book with Skip Intro Almost, because we're talking about adaptations of books that we have both loved and hated. It's been a mix so far. We've been focusing on TV, but after this, we're going to turn our attention to films, to the books that have made it onto the big screen. Keep it here on By the Book and let us know what your favourites and least favourites have been as well. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio and let us know. This is By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to By the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. We are talking about adaptations today because, and we can't say it enough, Good Omens is coming out at the end of the month.
This week, in fact.
That's right. So we thought, hey, when else are we going to get a chance to talk about Neil Gaiman and adaptations as if we need an excuse? So we've been talking about TV shows.
We have so far.
But up next, it's time for movies.
Yes, and you know, honestly, I struggled so much with this because when you think about it, there have been some darn good adaptations of books. We like to think there aren't because there's so many that have gone so bad.
Yes.
But there are actually some, I think historically, so much of good cinema has actually drawn from books.
That is very true. And I think there's also been a little bit of arrogance on the part of book readers. We saw this with Game of Thrones.
Yes.
We've seen this with a lot of other content as well, where it's like, oh, you like the movie? Well, that's just because you didn't read the book.
Exactly.
You know? But that level of snobbery, I think, doesn't really work when, as you say, there have been lots and lots of good adaptations. Let's just get a couple of them out of the way first. Let's talk about Stephen King in brief, because he is, I think, the most
adapted author ever, I think.
And that's partly because he's so prolific, partly because he also writes from a very cinematic reference point.
Yeah, and his stories lend themselves so well to being made into these weird sort of movies or TV shows.
However, they have not all been very good. I mean, you have a couple of exceptions, right? You've got, I think, The Shining, which he didn't like.
Yes.
You've got Shawshank Redemption.
Green Mile, which I like Shawshank and Green Mile very much, even though Green Mile, I think, has split fans.
Yeah. Green Mile was such a good novel that
it was.
The movie was good, but the book was better, I think. And then you've also got Stand By Me, which was based on a novella called The Body. So there've been a couple, but for every one of those,
there are about three that are terrible.
Because of the sheer volume of films. Stephen King, the ratio is not exactly great. But the ones that have been good have been very good. There are also obviously ones that we're not going to, that we don't necessarily need to dive into, like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that Lord of the Rings is probably one of the best examples of how to adapt books into a movie, or movies in this case.
Legend tells of a ring created by an ancient evil that gave its wearer the power to enslave the world. Believed lost for centuries, it has now been found.
Is it secret? Is it safe?
This is the One Ring, forged by the Dark Lord Sauron. Sauron needs only this ring to cover all the lands of a second darkness. He is seeking it. Seeking it all. His thought is bent on it.
No one knows it's here, do they? Do they, Gandalf?
I personally have never thought that would be topped, especially when it comes to something like fantasy. Perhaps now with TV opening up a new avenue, yes, but still.
Not with the budget.
No.
I think not with the scale of what was done. So yes, of course, Lord of the Rings, it almost goes without saying. Moving on then to the ones that could very easily have gone wrong, but went very right. We both wanted to talk about The Godfather.
The Godfather, which again is one of those movies that always gets talked about when we talk about great adaptations. In fact, I think a lot of people who watched The Godfather don't realize or didn't realize that it was based on a book, especially I think people who watched it perhaps more recently or people who are of our generation for whom it was always a movie.
Yeah, a very quotable movie.
Yes, but it was also a very good book. And I think it was a difficult book to adapt and in many ways could have been cheesy or just focusing on the crime aspect. But instead, we got this sort of dramatic family saga that just hits you.
Cheesy or insincere, I think inauthentic, that there's something about the way The Godfather is written. I mean, I read it far too young, and then I reread it again, still far too young. But I loved that book growing up because it just captured me right away. The opening with the wedding, the realization of who these characters were, that scene in the Italian restaurant with the gun in the bathroom. Like, there are just so many moments. And even writing about them or reading it was the movie felt as if it was the inside of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's the easiest way to explain why I've always felt that it was such a wonderful adaptation, because when I watched the movie, it felt familiar in a good way.
No, it makes complete sense, because I think one of the brilliant things about The Godfather 1 and 2, 3 is not my favorite, but is the fact that you watch it and you feel like the book has been brought to life. Not in a way that feels forced, but in that this is how this must have looked like. This is how this would happen. I'm not sure how to exactly explain why there's something quite magical about it, because as readers, that's what you want. You imagine a scene in your head. You read, as you said, these pivotal moments, and you want to know that that's what it would look like.
I wonder whether it's because of the filmmaker, because Francis Ford Coppola is that kind of filmmaker,
yes.
Right? He's a very specific sort. And I just wanted to throw in a quick mention of Apocalypse Now.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
I hadn't been a soldier since I was 19, and I still haven't learned how to wait for it. I wanted a mission for my sins. They gave me one. Nobody'd ever gone on a mission like it before. And when it was over, I'd never want another one.
Based on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, it's not set in Africa. It's, of course, set in Vietnam. It's set in the Vietnam War. But the key things, and to go back to what we said right at the top of the show, which was that a good adaptation requires tone. What Apocalypse Now manages to capture about Heart of Darkness is that nearly hallucinogenic, obsessive, dark tone that informs what is actually a very slim book to become this gigantic monster of a film.
But isn't that... I mean, I feel like sometimes that might be also the point, in that the fact that Heart of Darkness was a slim book allows the filmmakers to sort of build on that premise and move on in interesting, move away in interesting directions and still keep true to the heart of the original story.
Also, Heart of Darkness is almost an allegory. It has archetypal characters. It has characters that you could fill in with all sorts of... So when you find Marlon Brando in the jungle, you're like, oh, okay, I see. You know, so it had, again, that same lived-in, familiar feeling of watching it and going, oh, I recognize this. I know where we are. And I just really appreciated that. Moving on to the one that you wanted to bring up.
Well, I was going to actually say that I actually felt similarly in terms of that idea of a story being fleshed out to something greater. In Joseph Conrad's case, I wouldn't necessarily say greater, but I was going to bring up The Hunger Games. Because for me, The Hunger Games is a YA series, obviously, a YA trilogy by Suzanne Collins. And for me, the first book was really everything it needed to be. But it was a YA book.
Yeah.
There was there were a lot of interesting ideas that perhaps weren't as fleshed out as they could be. The movies took those ideas, and especially the ones in the subsequent books, and fleshed them out to be... I think a lot of people underestimated the trilogy as being for teenagers, but it really took on issues and tropes that were so much bigger. And in the end, turned out to be something quite amazing.
Are you coming to the tree? They strung up a man. They say who murdered three. Strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you?
And, you know, these little touches like making up that song that Jennifer Lawrence sings, The Hanging Tree, you know, emphasizing what trauma can feel like and what it is for characters to go through these things and not actually come out of them okay. That's something that the movies managed to do a lot better than the books did.
Yet the books, I think, suffered a little bit from pacing issues.
Yes.
So the first book is great. The first book I read and I thought, I need to know what's going to happen next. I need to know. But the subsequent books I read with that same sense of urgency, but a growing decline in joy.
Mm-hmm.
So the movie, on the other hand, I think managed to keep all of that going, you know, at a higher pace. And again, we come to, sometimes it's going to be about the performer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, in this case, they found the perfect Katniss.
So for me, I did not like Katniss in the books at all. So that was the big significant change when I watched the movie and I thought, I like her now. I get who she is. I get who she is so much more watching Jennifer Lawrence play her than I did reading the book.
I didn't like Katniss either, but I liked that I didn't like her.
Yes.
I appreciated that I didn't like her.
So, I mean, I think that hits the nail on the head. Jennifer Lawrence plays her as a person that you didn't need to like, but you could spend time with. Like, right. you could watch and get her. In the books, she used to irritate me. I think that's something that's very difficult to do. And again, a good performer manages to pick up on those things.
All right. So we have been talking today about our favorite adaptations. Not strictly a book show, still kind of, you know, hugging the periphery, but also
based on books.
Yes. Talking about our favorite adaptations in terms of TV and film, and all this, of course, ahead of Good Omens, which is coming out this week. Now we come to Footnotes, a segment of the show where we just throw in our thoughts, news, anything that didn't fit into the main body of the show, really. And since it was a show about adaptations, we thought we would finish by talking about books that we think would lend themselves well to being fleshed out visually, whether it's TV or film. What would you like to kind of push forward?
Well, I was initially going to say that I've always wanted to see Isaac Asimov's Foundation series made into a TV show, especially in today's age. However, because Apple TV or Apple Plus has actually picked it up as a show, they've not announced when the show's actually going to come out. I'm going to pivot slightly to a related Asimov series, which is the Robot series, which is kind of related to Foundation, but is set a lot more in like a futuristic, it's a futuristic detective series where a human detective pairs up with a robot and solves these crimes, which turn out to be a lot more than just simple crimes. I think it would work amazingly well, both in terms of just visually. It's less epic in scope because Foundation would be more like a space opera, mm-hmm. whereas this would very much be set in a future Earth that I imagine. Of course, this is all how I see it in my head. A sort of Blade Runner type future. And just, I like this idea of the human and the robot sidekick. And yeah, that's, I'd love to see that show.
Now's kind of the right time for it, too.
I think so, too.
Yeah, we're just kind of at a point where there's a growing number of these sorts of shows, but not too much.
Mm-hmm. And I think it also revitalizes a genre that's kind of gotten a little tired, the whole detective buddy cop kind of genre, which I think, you know, needs a jolt or two.
Is it True Detective with robots? I mean, can you imagine?
God, I would love True Detective with robots.
So just as an aside.
Netflix, are you listening?
If you're listening, I think what I would like to see is a book called Radiance by Catherine M. Valente. I would like to see that adapted. It's very, very difficult to describe, but it's a book that I read and then it stayed with me for such a long time. And it's about space colonization, but also about the search for a lost filmmaker who was off, you know, on a quest of her own. It has space whales. It has beautiful lands. It's ponderous and strange. It's been described by some as a decopunk novel because it's a bit, it defies descriptions of genre, but it also firmly sits in a very sort of aesthetic genre, if such a thing exists. You know, how things look are very important. They're described very sumptuously. I would love to live in that world. It is one that I would like to occupy. I think that it would either be a glorious failure mm-hmm. or a glorious, wonderful thing to watch. And either way, I think not living in the center of media is good enough.
You had me at space whales.
Dude, what else does anyone need? So yeah, I think it would be great as a mini series, just a little self-contained six-parter and call it a day.
I think it's interesting how we've both picked what are essentially from that speculative fiction genre because it really does fit into the kinds of adaptations that have been fairly difficult to do until very recently.
Yes.
And yet have actually turned out to be quite amazing when we've seen them done now.
So we want to see
Well, I want to see Isaac Asimov's Robot series.
I want to see Radiance by Catherine M. Valente. What would you like to see adapted? Let us know. Again, you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. We would love to know. And we will see you back here again next week on By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.